Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We are jumping right in today with a question that is so fundamental, maybe even a little uncomfortable.
It's a big one.
It is. Yes. And if the answer is yes, it means that a huge chunk of Western religious history, well, it's been operating under a profound 1,600-year-old mistake.
It's a truly radical thesis. And what's wild is that the whole thing, the entire argument, it really hinges on a single translation choice.
One word.
One word, made back in the 4th century. It's like a massive house that was built on, you know, one misplaced cornerstone.
Okay, let's unpack that.
Yeah.
So the provocative question we're looking at is this. What if the single most influential Bible translation in history just fundamentally misunderstood the Apostle Paul's mission?
Exactly. And it all comes down to how Paul's mission to the ethno was translated.
Ethno being the Greek word he actually used.
The Greek word, yes. The core of the problem, it really lies with Jerome and the Vulgate in the 4th century. Paul's mission was to the ethno.
Which is a pretty neutral word, right? It just means nations.
Totally neutral. It means nations, peoples, clans, that sort of thing. But Jerome translates it into the Latin gentilis. And that one choice, it created this powerful theological filter.
A reading mechanism.
A reading mechanism. That's a great way to put it. It's the filter through which the entire Western world has read Paul ever since.
So this wasn't just, you know, finding the closest synonym.
Not at all. It took that neutral term, nations, and it baked in the concept of the Gentiles.
Which in a 4th century context meant something very specific.
It explicitly meant non-Jews. So once that filter was installed, Paul's mission immediately looks like he's going out to convert random, totally disconnected pagans.
Okay, so the mission of this deep dive, then, is to explore the claim that his mission to the ethne was never about creating a new religion for non-Jews.
Right. It was about something much more specific, something completely rooted in Israel's own prophecies.
Announcing the restoration.
Announcing the restoration to the scattered descendants of the northern kingdom of Israel.
We're talking about 10 tribes exiled way, way back in 722 BCE.
Exactly. They were dispersed all throughout the Mediterranean world, living among the nations, among the ethno. So the core reframing here, and this is what's so critical for you to grasp, is that Paul wasn't abandoning Israel for the world.
He was looking for Israel within the world.
He was looking for Israel within the world. He was telling them the Messiah had finally come to regather Israel's scattered children, just like the prophets always said he would.
And this is where it gets really interesting for me, because if you adopt this lens, Paul, who can sometimes feel, you know, a bit contradictory, he suddenly becomes incredibly cohesive.
Yes, his whole life, even his most difficult letters, they just snap into focus.
So let's talk about the practical side, his geography, for example.
His geography makes immediate sense. I mean, why did he travel specifically through Asia Minor, Galatia, Macedonia?
Right, why those places?
Because those areas, they correlate remarkably with the ancient exile patterns of that northern kingdom. He wasn't just throwing darts at a map. He was, in a sense, working off an ancient census of where the lost sheep ended up.
And what about his method? The thing that's often just brushed aside, that he almost always went to the synagogue first.
Yes.
If he's just looking for pagans, why start there?
Exactly. Because the people he was looking for, these scattered Israelites, they had, you know, over the centuries, they'd lost a lot of their ethnic memory, their language, their deep connection to Torah. They were Hellenized.
But they're still nearby.
They'd still hover around the synagogue. They kept some kind of association with Israel's God. So Paul was looking for the dispersed family members who were still close enough to hear the call home.
And his most dense theology, Romans 9 through 11, which so often gets treated as this kind of three-chapter detour.
A side note about Israel's future, yeah.
It stops being window dressing. The sources claim it actually becomes the controlling framework for his entire mission. It's the why behind everything he's doing.
And that coherence, that new clarity, it leads directly to the collapse of a really central Christian idea, supersessionism.
Okay, let's pause on that word. It's a big one. For the listener, what exactly is supersessionism?
Supersessionism, or you might have heard it called replacement theology, is basically the idea that the church has permanently replaced Israel as God's covenant people.
So the church is plan B, the new and improved version.
Exactly. And it makes the old covenant and the ethnic people of Israel kind of obsolete. But what's so fascinating here is the claim isn't just that it's wrong theology, it's that it's a translation-driven inheritance.
Meaning the bias was literally baked into the Bible that Western Christians inherited. It didn't come from Paul himself.
Precisely. Let's talk about Jerome's motivation, that ecclesial agenda. By the 4th century, the church was the official religion of the Roman Empire.
It was institutionalized.
Highly institutionalized and overwhelmingly non-Jewish. They needed a clean theological break to justify their position, their claim to the covenant.
And creating the word Gentiles did that.
It created an absolute distinction between us, the church, and them, the Jews. The translation didn't just obscure Paul's language. It gave a linguistic justification for the church to replace Israel.
Wow. The implication of that is just staggering. If this is true, then centuries of Christian anti-Judaism, they just lose their theological footing.
They do. Because the core concept of the church replacing Israel was rooted in a misunderstanding of who Paul was even talking to. It didn't just change a word. It changed the whole relationship.
And once you change that relationship, you have to look inward. You have to look at the identity of Jesus himself.
Absolutely. The framework forces you to confront a really critical question about Christology. The source material points out that we, as Christians, we affirm Jesus' divinity, but we often deny the continuity of his life.
His lived Torah-shaped life.
Yes. We end up sort of correcting him with Greco-Roman ideas that came later.
So we're essentially saying, yes, you are divine, but we had to fix the way you lived.
It's a major inconsistency. Was Jesus's way of life complete, or was it provisional, needing a later fix? This whole idea shifts the church's identity from one of possession, we own the covenant now, to one of participation.
Participating humbly in Israel's ongoing story.
Exactly.
So how do we remember that humility? The source material offers this really powerful metaphor to help us grasp it, the Jacob's limp metaphor. Can you walk us through that?
It's a beautiful idea, and it's so memorable. You remember the story of Jacob wrestling the angel?
Mm-hmm.
He gets the blessing, but he walks away with a permanent injury, a limp. The metaphor suggests that the church was meant to walk permanently with a limp.
And what does that limp signify?
It signifies a permanent dependence, a constant gratitude and humility toward the people of Israel who carried the story and brought forth the Messiah. The church gets the blessing, but it retains a sign that it's not fully independent.
I see the power in that. And the metaphor goes further. What happens when the limp gets healed?
That's supersessionism. Replacement theology is what happens when the church forgets its origin story. It thinks it matured out of Israel, that it's the successful, healed version.
So it starts walking straight and tall, claiming ownership.
Instead of humbly participating, it's a profound call to humility.
And if you reposition the church like that, you have to reposition the Torah, the Jewish law. This view seems to bypass that old law versus grace debate.
It does. It does it without arguing for, you know, ethnic privilege, which is the fear everyone immediately has.
So how is Torah reframed?
It's not a discarded set of rules or a performance metric for salvation. It's the inherited wisdom of God's family. It's what is retained through the Messiah, not thrown out by him.
So obedience becomes participation, not performance. You're joining the family story, imitating the Messiah's life.
It changes everything about discipleship. It gives real substance to that idea of faith working through love. Love becomes an active thing, you know, participating in the family wisdom.
Okay, let's dig into the evidence trail for this. If Paul was really focused on regathering scattered Israel, we should see more than just his travel routes. What's the linguistic evidence?
It's his constant use of prophetic restoration language. He's not using general conversion language. Paul sees himself as fulfilling the prophecies of Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel.
And those texts were obsessed with regathering.
Obsessed with it. The restoration of both Judah and the scattered northern kingdom. He wasn't inventing something new. He was announcing that the old prophecies were finally coming true.
And this creates a kind of covenant logic.
It does. Paul's theology really only clicks if his audience had a prior covenant relationship with God. If they're total outsiders, they're just getting grafted into someone else's story.
Because they're descendants of Israel, even if they're assimilated.
Now, accepting the Messiah is the culmination of their own family story, not a rejection of it.
Which brings us to the centerpiece of the whole argument, the metaphor from Romans 11, the wild olive paradox. This seems to be where that translation filter did the most damage.
It absolutely is. Most Christians, when they read that, they assume the wild olive branches being grafted in are just random pagans.
Right. Grafted into the cultivated tree, which Paul says is Israel.
But the source material claims that if Paul's mission is restoration, then the wild olive branches don't describe pagans at all. The key is the distinction between wild and cultivated.
What's so important about that?
Because a wild olive is the same species as a cultivated one. It's not a different kind of tree like an oak or a fig. It's genetically identical.
It's just uncultivated, neglected.
Scattered and neglected, exactly. So the wild olive branch perfectly describes the Israelites who had been cut off, scattered like seeds. They still had their covenant identity, the seed of Abraham, but they were spiritually disconnected.
So grafting them back in isn't adding a new species. It's restoring the existing forgotten family members.
It's fulfilling the regathering prophecy. And the point isn't just to save the wild branches, it's to make the entire tree flourish again. The whole picture now makes sense.
So this completely recalibrates our eschatology, our understanding of history's purpose. Israel isn't a failed first draft.
And the nations are not Plan B. It restores the narrative coherence to all of Scripture.
Okay, let's address the elephant in the room, the big objection. If Paul was focused on scattered Israel, doesn't that minimize the mission to everyone else, to truly non-Jewish people?
That is the crucial question. And the thesis argues emphatically no. It doesn't narrow the scope at all. It just relocates it within the proper framework.
What do you mean by relocates?
The inclusion of all the other nations is absolutely central to Israel's calling. But the challenge here is to the idea of replacement. The nations are always meant to be included, but it's through the thriving, restored community of Israel.
So the restoration of Israel is meant to be the light that draws the whole world in.
Precisely. The mission becomes more expansive, not less.
And going back to that Jacob's limp metaphor, our history of Christian arrogance gets an explanation. It's covenantal amnesia.
That's a perfect way to put it. The church forgot its origin story, forgot who carried it, and that made humility impossible. Like a teenager who forgets they were adopted and starts claiming to be the original heir.
And the stakes here are so high. This isn't just some academic debate.
Not at all. If this is taken seriously, the church has to repent. And not just morally for its history, but interpretively. We have to change the very lens we use to read the Bible.
Discipleship shifts from just belief management, you know, checking doctrinal boxes.
Back to imitation. Imitating a Torah-shaped life, the one perfected in the Messiah, unity becomes possible again.
So for you, the listener, what does this all mean? The question isn't just whether we've been wrong for 16 centuries. The real question is, are you willing to look at the possibility that Christianity has been living off an inheritance it fundamentally misunderstood?
Are you willing to re-examine the lens you put on Paul, knowing that lens wasn't put there by Paul himself, but by a 4th century translator with a very powerful agenda?